Good morning, members and the public. Welcome to the Human Services Finance and Policy Committee. Members, we do have a quorum present. With that, I'll ask Chair Fisher. I know you are the first person to show up. If you will move the approval of the minutes.
Thank you, Chair Nora. I've reviewed the minutes from our meeting on March 5th, and I move their approval.
Thank you, Chair Fisher, for moving the approval minutes for March 5th, 2026. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The minutes for March 5th, 2026 are now adopted. To that, members, we have three bills today. And looking on the calendar, the first bill that we have is Chair Fisher. It's House File 3797. Good morning. Please move your bill and introduce it. Thank you so much.
Good morning, Chair Noor Committee. I'd like to move House File 3797. If I remember right, we're moving this to the Commerce Committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present House File 3797. This is a bill that's going to expand the definition of a partnership policy. A partnership policy is a long-term care policy that individuals are able to purchase. In current law, you are able to have those as long as you've got somewhere between a 1-3% inflation rate on it. And that was something that was last updated in terms of the inflation rate back in approximately 2015, 2016. What happened is back then when they made changes to it, people could, if they said had a 3% inflation rate on their policy, they could drop that at some point if they wanted to down to a 2% or 1% inflation rate. What happened is policies that were before January 1st, 2016 were not covered by that. And so there is a pool of people out there who've got these older policies who would like to change their inflation rate in that 1 to 3% range that aren't able to at this point in time. And so what this bill does is allow those older policies to be able to have the same rights as the policies that have been put into place since 2016.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for presenting the bill. Do we have anyone in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we now move to members' discussion. Chair Schumer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Fisher. Thank you for the explanation on the bill. I was confused because I'm not too familiar with these policies at all with this. And so is it correct in my understanding that this is giving an option for people to be able to increase the amount of inflation that is there, and then that would just go into the premiums that they're paying, or who benefits from this, I guess, is the bigger question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher. This allows people to have flexibility in that, whether they want to, say if they were at 1%, want to go up to 3%, or if they're at 3% and wanted to go down to a 1% inflation. And that does have an impact on their premiums. So that if they, say if they were going up, of course their premium would go up. If they wanted to go from 3% down to 1%, then that would make an impact on their, it would reduce their premiums a little bit. So if people are having a tight time at a certain point, they could reduce their premium down. Of course, that means they have a little less coverage at that point because of the inflation rate, but then at some point, then they could decide to change it from there.
Chair Schumer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Fisher, for that explanation. So if someone chose to go, say, from 3% to 1%, they get the lower premium. In the end, they'll just have less benefits when it comes time to utilize that, right? And vice versa.
Chair Noor, Chair Schumacher, that is correct.
Representative Beck.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chair Fisher, would this change Medicare benefits that a person would be getting down the road?
Chair Fisher.
Thank you, Chair Noor, Representative Backer. From what I understand, that in terms of the Medicare coverage, is Medicare doesn't cover long-term care. So that would not impact Medicare at all.
No other question.
Any other member discussion? Nope. So, Chair Fisher, your closing remarks, and we know your motion.
Thank you, committee, for the opportunity to present this. I would ask for your support to pass to, as I renew my motion, to have House File 3797 re-referred to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you. Chair Fisher renews his motion. House File 3797 be re-referred to the Commerce, Finance, and Policy Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is adopted. You're on your way to Commerce.
Thank you.
The next bill on the calendar is House File 3780. Representative Hicks. Please move your bill and introduce it.
Thank you so much, Chair. This bill is for possible inclusion.
Representative Hicks moves House File 3780 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Please proceed.
Thank you so much, Chair and committee members. This bill seeks to protect our shared services program, which allows a staff person to work with two people at the same time. Many times this is done in a situation where folks live together, siblings, spouses, things of that nature. However, what this bill does is making sure that the staff doing that work gets the fair share of the increased reimbursement rate that the provider receives. Shared services is an option in both the PCA program, both in traditional and PCA choice. It's also in CFSS, the agency model and the budget model. Under shared services, multiple clients agree to receive the services from the same worker at the same time. They might have two or three clients who live together at the same time. The state pays a premium reimbursement rate that is 150% for the two clients or 200% for the three clients. This saves money because we're not paying for more hours for individual services, and it also allows people the freedom of choice to live with whom they want and share their services. It's a great example of how we can be person-centered and fiscally responsible. PCAs who provide these services work harder, and they're saving the state money, and we should make sure that they get a fair wage. In the past, this really wasn't a problem. It was the industry standard to recognize the additional work of a PCA by paying a premium close to time and a half wage for two clients. But with the recent wage increases in the industry, because of the SEIU contract and all of the investments we've made in this committee, we have seen cutbacks in that increased wage premium. It turns out there's no requirement in rule or law that says the increased money the provider gets should be passed on to the PCA who's doing more work. This bill borrows from the wage pass-through mechanism that is part of the current enhanced PCA CFSS rate. In statute, clients who qualify for more than 10 hours of service get 12.5% higher rate. The statute requires 100% of the increase to be passed on to the workers and don't intend to push for 100% pass-through. Because shared services do impose extra administrative work for the FMS providers. I want to work with DHS and the provider groups who have put letters in your folders to find a percentage that really does work for everyone. The percentage currently is blank in the bill because we still are working through some of those conversations. The main language for the PCA program starts in Section 3, and we define additional revenue for shared services and then Subdivision 17D dedicated to be the determined amount for employee wages and other wage-related costs. Section 6 and 7 more clearly define the shared services in CFSS statute for agency models, and then Section 8 provides for the pass-through mechanism. Similarly, in Section 9, more clearly defines shared services in the CFSS statute for the budget model, and 10 provides the pass-through mechanism. Like Section 3 for the PCA program, Section 11 defines the terms used in the pass-through mechanism. Subdivision 3 uses a slightly different term of budget savings for shared services because of the difference between the agency model and the budget model. I think we all agree that PCAs doing harder work deserves extra pay, and I hope all of us agree that we can have some role in making sure that that happens. This bill provides a mechanism to do that, What the right percentage is and exactly how this mechanism will be designed are things that I'm open to a conversation about and working through. But I hope we can do something this session to make sure that the money is going to the pockets of the workers as we intended.
Thank you so much, Representative Hicks. And just wanted to ask if there's anyone in the public who wants to testify. Ms. Johnson. Good morning. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Noor and Chair Schumacher and members of the committee. My name is Tavana Johnson. I've lived in St. Paul for the past 3 years. I work as a home care worker, and I am here to testify on behalf of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota in Iowa, where I also work as a home care organizer. Our union represents over 50,000 people who work in hospital, clinics, nursing home, and self-directed home care. Our home care members provide shared services to self-directed clients in both the PCA Choice Program and the CFSS budget model. We also provide home care services in the Consumer Direct Community Support Program. Working in home care with our members, I know firsthand that shared care services are a vital program that keeps families together, helps address our workforce shortage, and saves the state money. Because the program works so well for everyone, it was common throughout the industry for workers to get paid time and a half or double time for serving extra clients at the same time. That was why I was so surprised and disappointed at the start of the year when another home care worker, Cynthia, came to me with a pay problem. She was providing shared care to two clients. The reimbursement rate to the agency by the state was 150% of the regular rate, but she was only getting paid $27.30 an hour. This was a few dollars more than the $21.50 per hour minimum wage for a single client in our contract based on her cumulative hours of service on the wage scale that we've established in our union contract. If she got paid the same 100% premium that the FMS provider was being paid, she would have been paid at least $32.25 an hour. She was probably being shorted about $4.95 per hour. When Cynthia and I approached the agency about this issue, we initially had some success because time and a half has been a well-established past practice in the industry. We were initially able to get them to agree to pay Cynthia the higher wage with back pay. She was able to collect over $3,000 in back pay. More importantly, they agreed to apply the same policy to all workers who provided PCA services. But our success was short-lived. I don't know why, but the company quickly reversed course and would no longer commit to paying time and a half. Maybe they realized how much money they would keep for themselves by not paying workers as much. They certainly learned what I discovered. There is no law or rule in Minnesota that requires that any of the higher shared service rate go to workers. There is a 100% pass-through from the extra 12.5% extra that is paid as an enhanced rate for clients who need more hours of care. But nothing protects workers who serve two or three clients at the same time. Because there is no law requirement, we are seeing more agencies pay less than the premium made possible by the state rate, which, like I said, used to be a normal and customary to see agencies pay at the same percentage they received. By providing care for two or three clients means a lot of extra work. There are some efficiencies, but you still need to assist with twice as many activities. You may need to help dress people, bathe, and help them toilet themselves twice as much. All the extra work is physically demanding, and there is less slow time to catch your breath. The extra money for time and a half or double time can make all the difference in the world of a PCA who struggles to afford their lives. That money could help pay monthly household bills completely and on time, stock pantries, refrigerators, freezers with healthy and nutritious food items for themselves and their families as we see grocery store prices rise, or just do something fun for their children, like pay for summer camps or maybe a fun afternoon at the Nickelodeon theme park at the Mall of America. I want to thank the members of this committee for your strong bipartisan support for home care workers. We are here in part because you've helped raise wages in our industry. Our union supports this bill because if the state is paying higher reimbursement rates for shared care, there should be some promise that a fair portion of the extra money go to the people who actually provide shared care. Thank you so much for your time and the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We have another testifier via Zoom, Idil Abdul. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks so much for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Idil Abdul. I have a 23-year-old son who was diagnosed with profound autism when he was 3.5 years old. I'm also a trying to retire autism policy advocate. As you know, the idea and intentions were good for Community First Services and Supports, CFSS. It replaced Consumer Support Grant and Personal Care Assistant, PCA, services. The goal was to make it more person-centered for the recipient and the family. However, as always, the rollout from the Department of Human Services was nothing short of disaster for families, for counties, and providers. There are no clear guidelines between the agency and the budget model. There are no time frames for how long the consultation specialist finishes the plan, and so many more problems. The state Medicaid agency, as usual, has not done a good job in offering training to families, counties, and providers. Most, if not all, counties are confused on what is allowed, what is not allowed, especially for individuals with developmental disabilities, such as autism. The state Medicaid agency's website mentions a couple of things for the budget model, such as grab bars, devices, and devices to support someone with dressing. Both of them are for people with physical disabilities, not people for developmental disabilities, such as autism. While I appreciate Representative Hicks' current language on this bill about shared services when it's more than one person getting the services, that is not the case for people who have profound needs and need one-on-one. I don't think the bill goes far enough. CFSS needs a complete overhaul that addresses the needs of people with autism and other developmental disabilities. I also ask the legislators moving forward that anything that you write for the state Medicaid agency, you must embed for them to train that policy to count for counties, families, and providers to make sure that everybody's on the same page and we all know what we are supposed to do, because that is not the case right now, Mr. Chair and members. Again, thank you so much for the opportunity, and I wish it does go forward, but I do wish that somebody amends it and at least you talk about CFSS many, many, many problems that we face, particularly those of us who have children with developmental disabilities such as autism. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have anyone else in the public who wants to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we will now move to member discussions. Representative Buck.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Representative Hicks, my first question deals with, you know, how will DHS get this right? You know, when you're providing share services, how will this be billed correctly and documented correctly?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much for the question. So shared services are already happening. So it's already billed as is. So the way that shared services and CFSS works is the person has a Min Choices assessment. That Min Choices assessment determines their need. So in this case, two people or three people would have a Min Choices assessment. In that need, in that Min Choices assessment, it would indicate that they are eligible for CFSS. Excuse me. Once they are deemed eligible for CFSS, they would be referred to a consultation provider, which is part of all CFSS services that was passed by this legislature prior to my tenure here. And so they would have that consultation service. In that consultation service, they would work with their consultation provider to determine their plan. Once they determine their plan, they would write that plan. That plan would go back to their county worker. it, depending on the county, it might be the same person who did their MIN choices. It might be a different person, like their waiver case manager, or their, I'm sorry, their ongoing case manager. Sometimes it's the MIN choice assessor. It sort of depends on the county. And then that county worker would approve the service authorization that indicates CFSS. That service authorization is then put into the system, and the in the DHS system, and it goes into the magic place of green screens, right? And then the provider bills for that service. In CFSS, because it is our transition from PCA, EVV is used also. So we're using electronic visit verification with these situations. And so the provider would have the individual who's working go and provide the service. They would use the EVV. The EVV and the case notes would then transfer into the provider's database. The provider would submit their billing just like they do with regular CFSS or PCA services. That billing would go through the DHS process to be paid through the next warrant cycle and then passed through and paid. So all of none of that is changed in this bill. That's the current process. That is the way that it currently works. What this bill does is say that when it is paid, the wage of that person is reflected in the shared services.
Representative Beck.
Okay, so I appreciate that. So is there any additional safeguards or compliance operation to prevent fraud?
Okay, so let's run through the process.
Representative Hicks.
Sorry. The MIN choice assessor, who is a county employee, comes out and does the assessment and determines that the person has a need. So that's one check, right? The next check is that referral is sent to a consultation provider. That consultation provider is enrolled with DHS to provide that service. They meet with the family and make that determination. So there's another professional and another check, right? Then that consultation provider does not have the final word. That goes back to your county, again, to determine whether they believe that that plan is in alignment with what the MIN choice has said. So that's a third check. Then that plan is put into the system, and that is for to be billed against. Right? So the amount of service authorized. So the authorization is not unlimited. Your county has determined the amount that is authorized. So now that that's in the system. So now when the staff goes to bill, they use EVV or electronic visit verification to make sure they were there at the time they were supposed to be there. Also in CFSS, there is somebody who signs off on, if it's traditional, there's like a schedule. If it's consumer directed, there's a representative payee, or not payee, a authorized representative who signs off on all of the time cards, and then those are insured to make sure that they match the EVV, and then it is paid. So, yes.
Representative Park.
Okay, so, and you know, so it sounds like, though, we're using the same system before for verification. It doesn't seem like there's, unless I missed something, is there additional safeguards for making sure the people who are supposed to get the services and supposed to get paid accurately, it's basically the system is still, the mechanism to release the funds are still the same. This correct?
Yes, because this,
Representative Hicks.
This bill only makes sure that the staff that's getting paid is getting paid an appropriate wage. However, I do want to just say CFSS, as we have rolled it out, has not been smooth, but the actual EVV verification that we've been using in the state of Minnesota now for a few years is very high quality and is really something that I personally believe we should expand the usage of to prevent fraud across other programs. I think the EVV usage, the fact that we geo-track staff to make sure they're in the location that they are supposed to be when they're providing services, is a wonderful way to make sure that the people who are getting services are getting services. Okay.
One last question. Thank you. So with the increase on costs, is that coming from, where's that money coming from? From the Medicaid side, or is this going to come from the general fund, DHS? Where does, because there's additional money being paid out. So how's that being
handled? Representative Hicks.
This actually won't cost anything. This is just making sure that the extra funds that are already in statute that the providers are receiving to do the rate is already hired for shared care because, as I said in my testimony, typically providers just provided an enhanced rate when people were doing shared care. But because it's not in statute, not everybody is acting in good faith. So we're gonna tighten that up to make sure that we're paying the providers more for this service and that that money is actually going to the worker. There is no fiscal note.
Representative Burke.
When you say not acting in good faith, elaborate on that.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. That was maybe the wrong usage of the word. When they are getting paid a higher wage or a higher rate for the staff to provide shared service, but they're not passing that money on to the staff. We're asking someone to do two times as much work. We're getting 1.5% more in the rate, the provider, the we in that situation. So the provider gets 150% of the weight of the rate, and then the employee is not getting the increased pay. The provider is keeping those admin funds in some cases, and not in all. To be fair, it's not everybody, but we've had a few incidences now that mean we probably should make it clear that when we're giving you extra money for people to provide care to two people, you should be passing that on to your workers.
Representative,
no further questions.
Representative Muff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. You know, you talked a little bit about there being no fiscal note. So that's already been gone through. There's no need for a fiscal note. So in some of the lines under the pass-through and shared services, you have blanks in front of the percentages. Why are there blanks?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, as I stated in my testimony, the percentage needs to be discussed with a bit with the providers. We want to find an amount that's fair. I have no desire to say 100% of the rate should go to the staff person. Providers have admin costs. They have increases in their expenses too. It just needs to be fair, and it needs to be in statute. I'm not set on an exact number. I think that's a conversation that needs to happen with the provider industry as we figure it out. So that's why it's being laid over and why we're continuing the conversation.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. You know, with regard to where the money, what the provider is using the money for, this bill looks like it prohibits a little bit of the use for health, dental, insurance policies. So what if the provider needed that money and instead now he's forced to use it for, you know, in the way of labor? So how does the provider deal? How do you know that that's happening if the cost of the provider is going up on some of these other things? Or is this just a way to pass on more money basically to the employee?
Representative Hicks.
Well, I mean, at its core, it is about making sure the person providing the service gets a fair wage and the money gets passed on to them, right? But we already do this in disability services where we have percentages about how much needs to go to direct staff wages. And I would challenge all of us, in addition to just this bill, but in general, do we think that taxpayer Medicaid dollars should be going to providers and not being passed on to the people providing the services directly? Do we think that as a legislature, we should not have any say in what that percentage is? Do we think that should be a free-for-all? Because I disagree. I believe if you go into the business of providing services under Medicaid, which is welfare tax dollars, we should hold your feet to the fire about how much of that money goes to direct service. It is absolutely essential that when we are saying that our most vulnerable deserve these services and this is the rate we're going to pay, that the people doing that work are getting the majority of that rate. I do not think that we should just trust that it's going to go fine. I think we should have safeguards. I think we should have guardrails. And I think we should put minimum standards in, as these folks are not working in an environment where they're receiving compensation from the free market. They're receiving taxpayer dollars, and we should have some guardrails on what is done with that money.
Representative.
Sure, thank you, Representative Hicks. Just my last comment on it. You know, as far as the percent and knowing where it goes, that's something we ought to know too. So I think at some point that would be great to bring that back to us, because we want to know what happens to the as a core, not just the wages. We need to look at the whole thing here. And so I think it'd be important to know what those percentages are. Thank you.
Representative Gunn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I look at the outcome of this bill, and it would absolutely resolve an inequity that exists. And so I get that. And the question I have is, does it resolve it in the best way? For example, could it be resolved by a union negotiation, right? Could that be tucked into a union contract so that we as the government don't have to be quite as involved in the inner workings of a business model? So I think of like in an eye clinic, maybe a technician does a retinal photo, they perform OCT, or they do a visual field. The reimbursement for each of those three is different. Perhaps the level of complexity is a little bit different. They're still going to be paid their same hourly wage, having done any of those three different procedures at very different reimbursement rates. You know, it's kind of like, and I don't mean to trivialize this, but you know how sometimes you walk into the room and your two kids are arguing and you wish they could just resolve it on their own? Come on, you guys, figure this out. You got this. Why do you need mom and dad to come in every single time we turn around and try to hammer out some resolution? I'd much rather find the that you can resolve this in an amicable way between you without the involvement of us. So with all of that, would you please kind of let me know how is this resolution the best of all that we could do?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for the question. I actually really am excited to address that. To be clear, I have 8 children, and if I didn't resolve conflicts, people would be dead. So sometimes that is necessary.
Delete that.
There are just a lot of them. But the part of the problem is that the collective bargaining agreement only covers self-directed services. It doesn't cover the budget model. So again, I come back to what I said to Representative Murphy. Do we really think that in taxpayer dollars we shouldn't tell the providers when they're completely funded by taxpayer dollars how much of that funding should go directly to the workers that we say we so desperately need to provide the services? Mm-hmm. The collective bargaining agreement can do something for self-directed services, but it does not affect traditional services. There's a whole group of folks that get left out, and I don't think that we should spend taxpayer dollars for services and leave anybody out.
I understand that, and it makes good sense that maybe the collective bargaining agreement can't quite get to this extent, but I'm sure you also sense, and so part of what makes this a bit challenging also is the fact that we have these wage pass-through mandates in other areas. So in other words, this would create some equity with those other programs. So it is a conundrum. And I think it's good that we're having this debate. I want to hear more all sides of it. And, I think you can sense our reluctance to spoon feed and force businesses to conduct themselves in a certain way. But we also see the fairness issue for that individual who's providing that service to multiples. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, can I?
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. And thank you again. I want to reiterate, though, when we talk about Medicaid providers, I want to be really clear what we're talking about. I hear folks saying businesses, and they absolutely are businesses, but they are Medicaid providers. They receive all of their funding from taxpayer dollars. That is not the same as operating an iClinic where people pay you cash and where you have commercial insurance and where you may also take Medicaid, where you have a diverse revenue stream that's receiving different funds. That's a different conversation. When all of your funding comes from taxpayer dollars, the legislature has a role and a responsibility to make sure that those dollars are going for the intent that we say. It is not the same. And part of the reason that we keep having these conversations is, and this is my opinion, this legislature, going back way before many of us were here, has not done that. And so providers were treated as businesses and allowed a lot of longitude to not overstep on businesses, right? And now we're here. And I would challenge that we need to ensure that we are looking at providers as what they are, which is providers that are essential and provide essential services, but that do so with Medicaid taxpayer dollars, and we should respond accordingly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cora.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Hicks. And I know we've want to talk about some different perspectives here. I can offer my perspective from the provider side. And coming from a well-respected provider with a long history, I can tell you that whenever we got, I say we on the provider side, right, whenever the legislature was able to give increases, we welcomed the legislature telling us how much had to go to employees. Because at the end of the day, the conversations that we were having with employees about so many different issues would come down to how much staff were able to be paid to do the wonderful work that they do. And, you know, if you've worked in the field, you know, some days could be a cakewalk. Some days you might get punched in the head 3 times and have body fluids thrown at you, right? And you may not know what you're coming into. So I think rightfully so, people were asking for wage increases year after year after year. And when you're a provider who relies on mostly taxpayer dollars or donations, it's hard to get those even 10-cent increases for employees. And so from my perspective, when the legislature makes a move that says, not only are we going to give the provider more money, but we are going to ensure that the folks doing this work who have been committed without raises for so long are going to stick with it, because that's part of the issue then that falls on people with disabilities is that they lose their care providers to other industries or other companies who can offer more. And I'm really thankful that you're doing this work. And I would say that good providers who really want to keep their staff want other providers to be held to the same standard. And it's frustrating when you're in the position of taking in the legislature's increases and passing that right on to your own staff of your own volition and then seeing somebody else hold it back for other things. That gets really frustrating. And so things like this really help provide clarity for the provider, for the employees working there, that yes, when the state's passing this on, intending to give people wage increases to keep up with everything, that it is indeed being passed on. Again, from a provider side, I found that very welcoming, and it made it even easier to just show people, look, the state says if you do this work, you get this much. Here's the explanation. We didn't have to take that on and make decisions like that. It is very, very helpful. So thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, and thank you for that. I do want to be really clear. The reason we haven't needed anything like this is because many of our providers are already passing that on. But we've started to see a shift, and we don't want our taxpayer dollars to not be going directly to workers. So it's just tightening it up.
Representative.
You know, one thing that I forgot to mention, thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, like insurance for providers, it's way up. I mean, for health insurance, it's up 12, 15, 20%. And this year is the beginning of a strong increase is coming. So even though the state's not obligated for money, according to your fiscal note, somebody's going to pay for that increased cost. So when people come to use the services, because we've mandated that more of it has to go one way or the other, we really dictate to the provider how he's supposed to spend and compete. But at the end of the day, people will pay that 15 to 20%. Consumers will, customers will, patients will. And so I think it's a little bit deceiving to say that nobody will pay for this. There's no cost included by us when there is a cost to the taxpayers and patients. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you. I appreciate that sentiment. Frankly, many of our home care providers don't offer insurance, so there's that. However, the other piece is that, again, there isn't anyone paying, right? The recipients of these services are on Medicaid. The service is provided by providers who receive Medicaid reimbursement. The amount the providers receive is set by this legislature and is set. So there is no fiscal, because unless you're planning to increase the rate, in which case, let's go. I'm here for that. We can talk about it. But that piece is already baked in. So this is, again, it's not like the free market where people are paying for a service. This is taxpayer dollars completely through and through, from the recipient being on Medicaid to the rate going to the provider. All this bill does is say, if you're getting more rate, more money to provide this service, you need to be passing that on to the worker.
Representative.
Mr. Chair, are all of the providers solely Medicaid?
Representative Hicks?
Most, yes. Very few take any other payment source because cash payment is really, really hard to, frankly, get, right? So most providers are either Medicaid or private pay. Very few do a mixture. Some do, but very, very, very few do a mixture. And this would only impact those that are Medicaid. It would only impact the Medicaid claims portion.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, Representative Hicks. In general, if what happens is that we typically underpay with Medicaid what the actual service is valued at, and so if that person is going to stay in business, is going to be a provider, they will have to take some opportunities that they have. But what this does is it actually makes it so it's more expensive to deliver the Medicaid service if they're trying to stay in business, like many other areas where we try to subsidize at an undervalue cost, somebody's going to have to pick up the difference. And if they're going to be in business, they're going to have to find a way to charge that out. And so it all goes together. It isn't just what we do here. It's seeing them as a business, and I think that's really important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hicks.
I think Representative Murphy just hit on why we have fraud in Medicaid services. That's exactly why we have fraud in Medicaid services, because most of these providers do not take any other payment but Medicaid. And so the only way they can make it work, the way they have chosen to make it work, is by stealing from Minnesota taxpayers. That's literally the reason we are in this pickle that we are in. And what I am trying to do in every bill that I keep bringing in front of this committee is tighten those things up so that if it is Medicaid dollars, if you are a Medicaid welfare-funded business, we should have oversight of you. That's what this does. But the explanation you just gave is literally why we're here. That's how we got here. Because most of these providers in a variety of settings across this state do only accept Medicaid. And the description you just gave is how we got here, because we did not have the guardrails that we needed to prevent people from doing exactly what you just said. Exactly. That is 100% the point.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. I'd like to see that report where all of our providers are committing fraud, because that's really important. That's what we've been asking for. If that's the case, we have a lot more to talk about. But if you're saying that the majority of our fraud is coming from these providers that get strictly Medicaid, we have more problems to deal with. So
it's thank not you. What I said.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's not what I said. What I said was the business model of Medicaid fundamentally fails because, as Representative Curran said, all they can use is Medicaid funding and donations. And in this state, we have allowed for-profit companies to come into the space and bill Medicaid. Now, I have personally been opposed to that for a long time and have, I think everybody in this room knows how I feel about for-profit providers in the Medicaid space. It's not what I said. What I said was your explanation of why we should not put guardrails on is how we got here. Because we do not tell them what they can and cannot do with the Medicaid dollars, because we are not making sure that the money is going to the right places, we encourage, that behavior is encouraged fiscally. My goal is to stop making that popular. My goal is to say, nope, you can't do that. This is taxpayer dollars, you will use it for what we said. That's all this is. If I'm giving you more taxpayer dollars, I think you should use it to provide the service. If we increase the rate to make sure that people could get what they needed, you should use it for people to get what they needed. You should not use it to make a profit, period, because it's taxpayer dollars. And there are lots and lots of services that are multiple funding streams, diverse revenue streams. That is true. Eye clinics, as I spoke to Representative Gander about. But when we are talking about PCA, when we are talking about CFSS, this particular thing, Medicare doesn't cover it. Your private insurance doesn't cover it. Your only option is cash pay and Medicaid. How many people can pay that rate for an extended period of time before they run out of their safety net? It disappears real fast. And then we make them spend down all of their assets, everything they've saved, every single thing that they've worked their entire lives for before we will put them on Medicaid and provide services for them. That is the model we have in this country. That is not like a Minnesota unique problem. That is a national problem. And then when they finally do get to the Medicaid part, we have for-profit businesses that decide how to spend the money from taxpayers to provide that service. All this bill does is say, if we're giving you more money to provide those services, we'd like you to pass it on to the worker. That's it.
Any other member question? I've got a few questions. Just wanted to center this conversation because I know we went all over the place. So, Representative Hicks, we're talking about an individual who is providing care to two individuals. Instead of us paying for two, we just enhance the pay that we are giving to that individual. Is that correct about shared services? So we end up reducing the cost by not paying for two services for two individuals. Is that correct?
Correct. It saves the state money.
And then the second question that I have for you is, we have already set the minimum pay in the statutes that it's 72.5%. Is that correct?
Correct.
And so are we meeting that standard of 72.5% when we do the additional pay to that individual based on that transaction?
That is why we're bringing this bill, is to ensure that that occurs. Again, that's why the percentage is blank.
Correct. So with that, I think there will be a fiscal note just to test whether there will be additional costs associated with that. So we will be definitely be requesting, and I'm going to send for that. So we will have to get the percentages in. We will have to also have the conversation with stakeholders so that we can get it right, as you've had from everybody else. So I think this is a great, good conversation. If you're providing a services that is meant to be provided by two people, one person providing that services, then you deserve to be paid a fair share of the work that you've done. So with that, your closing remarks?
Thank you all for hearing this, and thank you for your open dialogue as we continue to make sure that our most vulnerable Minnesotans are getting the intention of every taxpayer dollar.
With that, Representative Hicks renews the motion that House File 3780 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you so much. We now have the final bill, House File 4068.
First on the list with questions. Is it going to be like this every time? Okay, as Chair Knorr gets settled, Chair Knorr moves House File 4068 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Chair Knorr, do you want to walk through the bill before we do the amendment, or do you want nonpartisan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, I will start with the nonpartisan to walk us over the bill.
So, Ms. Senderman, go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, I will walk through the bill summary that is in your packets. So this bill is actually fairly simple, even though it looks pretty complicated. It reorganizes and updates Section 256B.064, which governs MA sanctions. It also adds other language to a couple of sections to clarify how those statutes apply to the MA program. So starting with Section 1, this adds a new Subdivision 7 to Section 15.013. This was new, I believe, last year that governs payment withholds for state agencies as a whole. This new subdivision just specifies that this section doesn't apply to MA sanctions. This is partly because the withhold standard in that section is more stringent. It's a clear and convincing evidence standard. And also because DHS has to follow federal requirements, which 256B.064 follows. Section 2 similarly adds an exception subdivision to Section 245.095. This section applies to other programs within DHS. This new subdivision just clarifies that it doesn't apply to MA, that the current statutes apply to MA. Section 3, this modifies Section 256B.064 Subdivision 1B. It breaks out a list to make it clearer, and it also adds paragraph lettering and updates terminology such as shall to must, which is an ongoing reviser project. Section 4 is a very small change. It's a shall to a must for consistency. Section 5 is similar. This is just adding paragraph lettering and updating terminology. Section 6, this updates terminology and cross-references like many of the other sections. It removes language that is being moved to new subdivisions. So all of the language that is stricken in this in Section 6 appears later in the bill as new subdivisions. Section 7, this is a new subdivision 2A. It is imposition of fines. It adds a new subdivision that just inserts the language that was formerly in subdivision 2, paragraphs G and H. Section 8, a new subdivision 2B for mandatory suspension or termination after exclusion from participation in Medicare. this adds the new subdivision and it inserts the language that was previously in subdivision 2, paragraph E. Section 9, new subdivision C, 2C, imposition of or withholding of withholding or reduction of payments before a hearing. This inserts language that was formerly in subdivision 2, paragraph A. Section 10, which is new subdivision 2D, imposition of withholding or reduction of payments without prior notice. This inserts language that was formerly in subdivision 2, paragraphs B and C. Section 11 adds new subdivision 2E. This is language that was formerly in subdivision 2, paragraph D. Sections 12, 13, and 14 all update terminology and cross-references. These are conforming changes related to the rest of the changes in the bill. And section 15 adds a new subdivision to 256B.064. This just clarifies that this section on sanctions supersedes any inconsistent or contrary provision of law. And that's for comfort and clarity. And that concludes the walkthrough.
Madam Chair and members, I wanted to move A1 amendment, but I'll be explaining, as you've heard from nonpartisan staff, that House File 4068, as is right now, is reorganizing the statute that is related to 256B.064 so that it's clear, not only to the providers, but also to the courts and also the agency, and removes the any confusion that exists under the statute when it comes to the payment withhold, the sanctions, or suspensions. And so this cleans up the current existing statute. With the A1 amendment, Madam Chair, I'd like to move A1 amendment and explain it. So the A1 amendment provides an opportunity for an individual entity who is impacted by withholding, reduction of payment, and the opportunity to have administrative review, so that administrative law judge can take a look through an expedited process. That also gives a timeline of how that administrative process is done. It doesn't change the underlying process for the payment withhold or sanction. Under subdivision 7, it also includes when the payment is, when we have got suspension, withholding, or reduction of payment, that the commissioner must also review at least every 90 days. So this is also in compliance with what is required under the CMS rules, that we have to review every payment withhold or sanctions or suspensions under the federal guidance. And also under subdivision 8, we codify the requirement, which is actually required under the federal law, that there's coordination with law enforcement, MFUKU, state or federal agencies, to make sure that we are in compliance. And I think the section that I skipped is requiring notification to the legislature if there's a delay for 180 days. So if there's a payment withhold or sanction, that there will be a review by a legislative body, particularly the Human Services Chair and ranking members. With that, that is the A1 amendment.
Thank you,
thank you, Madam Chair, members. So this is strengthening the program integrity framework that we have. I know we've talked a lot about many things, but this is an opportunity for us to continue on the path, making sure that we have got clarity in how payment withhold or sanctions are implemented. I do have some testifiers who signed up to testify on the bill.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Matthew Bergeron, and I'm a healthcare and government relations attorney with the law firm of Larkin Hoffman. Normally, I come to this committee on behalf of a legislative client, but today I'm here as an individual capacity as a healthcare attorney who frequently advises Health and Human Services providers on various compliance matters and has represented providers navigating DHS investigations and enforcement actions. Thank you, Representative Knorr, for the opportunity to testify on House File 4068 and for the A1 amendment. I want to acknowledge, first of all, that program integrity tools are incredibly important, particularly in the conversations you are all having this session. Fraud in Medicaid undermines public trust, diverts resources from people, and frankly complicates the system for those providers that are working hard to provide quality care. And I think recent investigations and the media stories have highlighted some of the problems we're working through. And as you've heard, the statute being recodified in this legislation as it was originally presented to the committee outlines the Department of Human Services' authority to impose fines, sanctions, to recapture payments, to terminate a provider's enrollment, all important tools as part of that process. I think the underlying bill does a really good job of kind of breaking out those different authorities in a way that's more easily understood by both the providers that are navigating them as well as the agencies that are enforcing them. One of the big things that's notable in the A1 amendment is the language that creates a review of the temporary payment withholds. Across our Medicaid system, when the Department of Human Services sanctions a provider, there's a right to an appeal. They have the ability to request a contested case in an administrative law hearing, or if it's a criminal sanction, there's due process within our judicial system. The one place where that has not historically existed is in a temporary payment withhold. Courts in Minnesota have held that because it's a temporary sanction, because it's a pause in payments while an agency is being investigated, that there isn't a due process right to an appeal or a review. What the courts haven't done is establish what temporary means. And one of the things we have seen for years, and this extends well beyond our current moment in time, the current leadership of the department, is that these temporary payment withholds can go on for months to years. In my practice, I've represented agencies that have had their payments shut off, have resulted in closing the services, terminating their service agreements, transferring clients or residents to other service providers. And then their question is, when do I hear what's next? And I've had clients where we've gone multiple years without having heard any investigation or sanction. I've had clients where 12 months later, they get a letter that says, we've completed our review, no fraud, you can go back to billing. And by that point, the agency is long since gone. We've had to navigate kind of the churn in the system. Representative Hicks did a really nice job in a prior bill talking about the assessments and the placements and the reviews and the service plans. You have to redo that when somebody's getting transferred. Not necessarily the assessment, but a lot of the service plans and the authorizations all have to be done differently. And so there's a lot of disruption in those instances. And so I think that one of the things that has been difficult is those temporary payment withholds haven't always resulted in charges being brought, a permanent sanction being pursued, something where an agency has a ability to ask the question, what am I being accused of? What is going on here? And so the A1 amendment that Representative Knorr brings forward is a big part of that process and adding a little bit of due process in that system. And so I think that is a really important thing kind of across all service lines. I think as the legislature and as this committee goes forward and is looking at matters like this, there's a number of interests that I think that the committee will need to balance. You know, on the one hand, obviously, the Department of Human Services and the Attorney General's Office are going to want to be able to make their case. If they find an agency that they believe is committing criminal fraud, they want to be able to shut off those payments and they want to build their case. So, of course, they're not going to want to show their evidence early. At the same time, there are, you know, our systems are complex. The rules for a lot of our programs are not in statute or in rule. They're in guidance. They change. They evolve. Mistakes are made. Things are misunderstood. Different parts of the department give different advice on the same criteria, and there's an inconsistency there.
And so we also want to make sure that there is an opportunity for a provider that maybe is perceived one way to have some ability to clarify or explain or navigate that. And so I don't think those two goals are irreconcilable, but it's absolutely a big part of the conversation here. Similarly, federal law authorizes state agencies in situations like this to issue what's called a good cause exemption. So they can look at it and say, yep, we've shut off payments to this agency because we think there's fraud there, but there's a reason to resume those payments temporarily while we navigate something. Oftentimes it's access to care, it's resident or patient safety. I think that's particularly notable in provider-controlled residential settings where it's like, if there's nobody providing care, this person's unsafe until we can find some time. So it's better to, while we're watching them and while we're investigating, to pay to make sure that that person's safe until they can be transitioned. That's a tool that's in federal law that I think is available, maybe could be codified in state law, and is not something that, in my experience, is used particularly regularly, and I think is a part of it. And so all of that is to say, Madam Chair and committee members, I think that Representative Noor's recodification bill and the A1 amendment are really important to kind of clarifying a lot of authorities, ensuring some navigable processes in all of this. And it is really, you know, not to speak for the chair, but my perception, the start of a very important conversation that's part of the broad work you all are doing this legislative session. So I appreciate the time and the opportunity to speak with the committee.
Thank you. Do you want to stay nearby just in case anybody has questions for you? Is there anybody else in the public who wishes to testify on this bill? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Representative Gander.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I understand the package that's been presented here, the bill itself gives better teeth and tools maybe to identify, prosecute fraud, and claw back the money. So that's the crux of that bill, is to really tighten up our ability to prosecute fraud and claw back that money. The amendment brings in some provider protections, which are a very good thing. So it sets some timelines so we don't have people out there dangling in the breeze waiting for a resolution that finally, as you say, a year later it comes. Oh, you're exonerated. Go ahead, get back to work. No, I can't. I cannot reconstitute my practice from a year of absence. So is that kind of the crux of what we heard? Let's start with that. And then I do have one question.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gander. I think to some extent you're right. So the key question on the bill, the original before the amendment, it just reorganizes what already exists in the statute. So it's cleaning up, removing old language, and making sure that we do have a clean process so that the courts, the providers, the agency, everybody's clear of what needs to be done, including, I think you've seen from that exemption under subdivision 7, which takes out the chapter 256B, actually it removes the 15.013, and also under subdivision, the exemption subdivision 7, section 2, also removes the 256B from 245.095. It confuses. Because right now, if you read, there's a payment withhold that is in the statute that we passed, I believe, last year. That is 15.013, and it really doesn't help. Which statute are you using? When Medicaid is governed by the federal statute, this is exactly how it's developed. So we're not changing anything underlying, but also we're changing shall to a must so that we have got enough clarity in that. With the A1 amendment, it provides an opportunity for a provider or an entity or individual to be able to go to the administrative law judge and say, what have I done wrong? Nothing changes. The administrative law judge is going to look into the preponderance of evidence and see, was there something that the commissioner should continue with the payment withhold? So this just gives them the opportunity. And I think I was trying to find the line. Maybe I can ask for nonpartisan help. The payment withhold is exempt from Chapter 14. I believe that was initially drafted so that the contested cases don't apply to the payment withhold. So at least in clarity, you do have now an option to go to administrative law judge just to review if the case should continue. And also there are guardrails if there's a requirement by law enforcement that nothing needs to be provided to the provider because of ongoing investigation. So all those things apply, because once a payment withhold is done, the agency doesn't have to tell you anything while they're doing the investigation. You're able to send a letter of explanation of what happened, but they don't have to tell you what happened. So this gives them an opportunity just to lay out and say, can you please take a look at this? So the agency will have to present that to the administrative law judge. The administrative law judge will make a determination based on the facts.
Nonpartisan, did you want to answer the line question? Ms. Sunderman, or we can come back to you.
Go ahead. I think I'll look into that. I didn't see that section in the recodified process.
Sounds good. Representative Gander?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my final question is, you know, we've been trained that as you read legislation or you read a law, there's such a difference between may and shall. On the one hand, may would imply that you have the option, and shall means you will do it. But I've never seen the difference between shall and must. Would you tell me in law, then as we even go forward making new laws, the difference between shall and must? Thank you.
Is that nonpartisan? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Gander, there is no difference between shall and must. It's a reviser preference to update statutes where we can.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
That's it?
Okay. Good.
Representative Backer.
Thank you. It helped me understand. It seems like with changing these statutes, actually seems like there could be a legal loophole for defense attorney on just dragging this process out, challenging the sanctions and so forth. I know we have to update, but the updates seem, and correct me if that's wrong, that there could be a legal loophole just to drag this out, because, like you said, we sent out a letter and your administrative judge. Help me with that.
Chair Noor.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This is just a normal standard process. If there is anything that, maybe somebody is denied benefits, you're allowed to go through administrative hearing to determine if that needs to be, if it was correct. So it doesn't mean that there's a loophole in the process. Anytime that you want as a provider, you can go to the court, district court. Nothing denies you that opportunity, but the outcome is going to be remaining the same. So this makes sure that you do have at least an opportunity for administrative law judge to look at the evidence that is being presented by the agency and make sure that there's accountability and also transparency when there's a sanction imposed on an individual or an entity. So this does not mean that the payment withhold will be removed, that the sanction will be removed. It just allows for the administrative law judge to say that the commissioner, based on the sanction imposed, is correct and it needs to continue. That's all. I don't think it denies you the opportunity to go to the court.
Okay.
Maybe I can ask my colleague who goes to the courts to identify the loophole so we can close it.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair and Representative, so there's nothing in the underlying bill or the A1 amendment that has any impact on the as I read it, on the department's ability to pursue any of their normal sanctions, to kick a provider out of Medicaid, to fine them, to recapture money. It doesn't impact any of that. Similarly, there's nothing in here that has any impact on a criminal justice proceeding where somebody is being charged by the Attorney General's office. What the A1 does is it creates some timelines, processes around a temporary payment withhold. That's that stopgap holding of funds while the state is pursuing those other investigations to create some opportunity for administrative oversight, because the current statute has been interpreted by the courts, both state and federal, as providing nothing. So I don't think that there's anything in the A1 that would impact the Department of Human Services' ability to permanently remove a provider, to fine a provider, to or to criminally prosecute somebody involved with a fraudulent provision of services.
Okay.
Chair
Follow up, and that's what's important to a lot of my constituents, because that's the frustration that we have seen with both sides, not just our the Republican side, but making sure dollars are getting to the right people for the right services. Final question that I have is, How does this change, does it work in line with the, it seems to work in line with the Medicaid integrity rules? We're in the same guardrails. It doesn't go outside of those guardrails.
Chair North.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. But this is exactly how it's defined under, I believe it's 42 CFR 455, if I'm correct, or 23. Exactly the way it's defined. It also allows for that administrative review. In fact, many states use the same. If you look at Texas, Florida, and other states, they provide the expedited administrative law judge review.
Chair Becker?
No further question. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. No other questions. I have a question. It's more around the good cause exemption that you were talking about. So in Greater Minnesota, one of the things that I am worried about and was really worried about, I'm sure we're probably more worried about it on this side, is the geographic spread. If a closure would happen and it would be 100 miles that then is the closest to the next service provider, would that be an element that would be fit under the good cause exemption?
Madam Chair, if I may start, I think under the good cause, the commissioner will have to look at the totality of the case. It's case by case. If there is an instance whereby a good cause can be provided, which is also allowed under the federal law, is to make sure that there is continuity of care. If somebody is on ventilator, you don't want to disrupt that, given the even the example that you noted. Also under A1, we're allowing the administrative law judge to look into that and say, this individual will need care ongoing instead of the full payment. Under the same rules, you're allowed to make partial payment until there's a transition. We've got a different conversation that is going to be coming on Thursday. But yes, good cause is applied when there's medical necessity to make sure that the individuals who are getting services, those services are not disrupted, knowing that there's an ongoing investigation. So this is looking into the credible allegation of fraud. And I'll let my colleague, who is a practitioner, to note how that whole process works.
Madam Chair, the situation you described, the one provider in a community is under, you know, a credible allegation of fraud. There's a temporary payment withhold there. But the federal law, that's exactly the scenario that the federal regulations contemplate when the Medicaid agents could look at it and say, yep, we've imposed a temporary payment of withhold here. But we're really worried about what would happen to the people if they're not able to provide service here. So we're going to release funds. There's oftentimes some other intervention of oversight there. But we're going to essentially temporarily lift our temporary withhold in order to make sure that folks are cared for, that folks are safe. Usually, while there's an extra level of intervention, transitioning folks out of the one nursing home in the county or working with the one residential behavioral health program in the region or whatever those situations might be. That's exactly what the federal regulations contemplate as the kind of discretionary authority that it gives state Medicaid agencies.
Madam Chair. And also for that reason, I think my colleague pointed out nursing home is excluded from this whole process. I think there's a different process and parts so that there's a protection for those residents in a nursing home or other settings like TCU where there's a care needed. So all those things, the exemptions are already included even in this bill. I think it's in this, if I may ask the nonpartisan just to point out that as a good example.
Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Knorr, are you talking about the reference to the good cause exemptions? Is that what you?
Yes. Okay. When it comes to a setting like a nursing home, where there's an exemption allowed under this statute.
Ms. Sunderman.
Madam Chair, members, specific to a nursing home, I would have to look through this and get back to you. The good cause exemption in the underlying bill is on page 7, line 23. It cites the federal law, but I would have to get back to you and look through for an exemption specific to nursing homes.
Thank you. Chair Noh, do you have anything to follow up with on that?
Nothing else to follow up, Madam Chair.
Okay, with no other members to discuss, Chair Noh, to your final comments on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is just a way to protect taxpayers' money and also to ensure the continuity of care for those who need the most. And as we continue to discuss program integrity and addressing the challenges that we are faced with, we have to come up with solutions that are workable and to be able to assist the state in making sure that we have right decision-making process. I look forward to having more conversation on this bill so that we are ready to proceed. With that, Madam Chair, renew my motion, House File 4068, as amended to be laid over for possible inclusion.
This bill is laid over. Okay, we're done with the day. Look, I gave you guys a half hour back of your time. You're welcome. Landed the plane early. We will get to be back here tomorrow morning at 8:15. With that, the committee is adjourned.